Greetings, this is James Gillen with As You Wish Talk Radio. We've got another great show tonight. We've got Captain K, and he's a U.S. Marine super soldier who served for 17 years on Mars, defending the Mars colonies. He was part of the Project Moonshadow and was assigned to the Mars Defense Force from a covert military branch, United States Marine Corps Special Section, set up by President Eisenhower. And Laura Eisenhower was just here at the ranch, so that was quite a synchronicity there. But it's a unit that would uphold moral ethics and hopefully keep things in check in regards to the activity of MJ-12 and other more unscrupulous members. You know, his story information accounts give us insight into things that other whistleblowers have been speaking about in relation to Alternative 3 and the establishment of bases on Mars. Since he has spoken out because of his chain of command requested him to do so, he's less of a whistleblower and more of a direct representative of the U.S. Marine Corps. Is it, Secret Services or?
Special Section,
okay. So he has experiences that take us into an in-depth understanding of ET races that are interacting with Earth, covert agendas that are affecting the whole of humanity, and information about off-planet military activity that has been kept secret, black, and he's now sharing that with us. So without any further ado, I want to bring Captain K. Are you with us?
I am here. Thanks for having me, James.
Hey, thanks for coming on the show. You know, I got a bazillion questions for you, but it's only an hour show, unfortunately. But
We'll do whichever ones you want, and then, you know, you can always have me back another time if you want to ask me more questions.
Yeah. I've been fascinated by it. My understanding is that we've been going back and forth to Mars since the 60s, and who knows, maybe even before that.
My understanding is the first unmanned probe that we sent was in like 1963, and then our first manned mission to Mars was in the late 60s, and that we had our first base or the first colony or whatever they had started on Mars in about 1973. That's what I understand to be that timeline.
Okay, great. Yeah, because that's the information I always got somewhere in the 60s. I never could get details on that.
There's actually a video that's gone public. You can get it off of YouTube. I should actually put a link to it on my site because it's a really great video. Someone leaked the video from the probe as it's landing on Mars, and you can hear the Russian and American. It was a cooperative Russian and American project. You can hear the voices of the Russian and American controllers talking, and then you can see them touching down. And then you can also see something that is startled by the landing of this probe and dives off under the sand, and then you can see that as it tunnels away under the sand and it steers away from the probe, which is very fascinating, I think, because I've seen them do that. I've seen them, hunker down in the sand like that and then just dig down right into it and, you know, really scoot away like watching a Bugs Bunny cartoon, you know, like it's under the ground, and it is just one of the most surreal and yet amazing things to actually see and watch. And it's on that leaked video, so you should look that up.
No, what was this? It was some type of creature that just burrows and takes off?
No, indigenous reptoids do that.
Oh, okay.
I you can't really see him because he's hiding in the sand as the thing comes down, and so all you really see is him sort of disappear into a hole in the bank, and then, you know, the tunneling, the bump of the tunnel as he runs away. But they really hunker down right there in the sand, you know, with covered up in a thin layer of top sand that you can't see them. And then when they disappear, they scurry off. They don't run over the ground. They burrow, and they burrow really, really quickly.
Mm-hmm. I know there's a lot of snakes that do that on the Earth. You know, they have sand snakes and things like that go under the sand pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's impressive. I was really impressed to see just how fast they could do it.
Now now what's the nature of these beings? Are they negative or towards humans?
No, I would not say that they're negative towards humans. I'd say that they're very species centric to what is going on in their world. They're much more concerned about their own affairs and their own planet's affairs and their own health and well-being and the well-being of their planet far more than they're concerned about anything else. And we're less of a concern. We're no concern whatsoever to them as far as what we're doing on our own planet. As long as it doesn't affect them, they really could care less. And our visiting them or living there even is tolerated as long as we're not, you know, a threat to them or appear like we're trying to, you know, take over the planet. As long as we're just hanging out in a little corner and sharing whatever space that they've got, that they really are okay with that. They don't seem to mind so much because they're very self-centered about just their priorities. Not to say that they're self-centered species so much, but they're very self-centered about their priorities. They're really about taking care of themselves and their planet before they do anything else.
Now, there seems to be a lot of different life forms on Mars, according to other whistleblowers. Maybe we can get into that, some of the things that you've experienced.
Sure. There are two sentient indigenous species, meaning two intelligent evolved species, one reptoid, one insectoid. The reptoids can be anywhere from, I'd say, about, you know, smaller warrior males or females can be, you know, 5.5 feet to, you know, 6 feet tall. And the bigger ones, the bigger males and the bigger warrior can be 7.5 feet tall and really thick and broad and, you know, upwards of 400, 450 pounds. They're large, really quite large. They have a very tough outer skin and a really, really strong and supple bone structure. So their bones bend quite a bit, so they don't break very easily. And they have two hearts. They have a sort of an internal organ circulatory system, and then the circulatory system that feeds the extremities, the arms and the legs, and two hearts in the middle of the chest. So you really, when you're fighting them, you have to cause blood pressure loss in both systems before they drop. So they can be really formidable with those two hearts in that chest cavity that's really, really hard to get through. But again, they're not typically aggressive with us, but that doesn't mean that we don't have different reasons why we haven't gotten into fights or conflicts. They're otherwise very intelligent, but essentially after the incident of the destruction of their environment many, many thousands of years ago, they've become very decentralized and very tribal. So they pretty much don't really exist or function as a global or planetary organized species or government at all. They're very, very tribal at the moment and sort of manage their own underground sort of cities, states, whatever you want to refer them to. And I would sort of have to define the southern tribes, anything on the southern hemisphere, as being way more aggressive and way more hostile and subscribing to a life philosophy of warriorism where everything is about, you know, learning, growing, and understanding and improving things through combat. And so they'll just attack anything that shows up, not really so much out of hate, but out of this is what we do. And if you're worth anything, you'll be able to defend yourself. And if you're not worth anything, then we'll kill you. And you'll demonstrate that you're weak, and we shouldn't expect you if you're weak. That's basically their attitude. The northern tribes are more complicated. I wouldn't say that they're more warm fuzzy. I would just say that they're very different. They have a little bit more intellectual, spiritual approach to what they're doing and have a bit more of a long-term philosophy about what caused the accident, how responsible they feel for the accident that blew out their atmosphere and destroyed the surface of the planet, and how they feel like they have to spend as much time as it takes, you know, healing the planet, terraforming and fixing their society and their culture from the culture that destroyed their planet and fixing the planet from really being destroyed. So they're, again, I wouldn't call them super warm fuzzy in the sense, like, if you go say, hey, how you doing, they still might kill you and eat you if you don't show that you're strong or respectable. But they're not, again, necessarily hostile or have any intentions of openly attacking or have no designs on whatever we're doing down here on planet Earth. It's no concern for them. The insectoids, again, also very intelligent, very complicated because they're insects. I would have to say that I understand the reptiles a little bit better than I do the insects, because at least we have a reptilian brain and there's some commonalities that are a little bit easier to understand. Insects are very difficult in some ways to understand because they're insects. I wouldn't say that they're bad or negative because of that either. I'll say that, again, they have their own priorities and their own value system. And they're very intelligent, very scientific, have a complex metaphysical view of their world and their reality, and have a really, really amazing grasp on bioengineering and self-genetics. And that's pretty much how they engineer their entire culture and hatch, you know, thousands of whatever they need at a time, you know, through very complex biogenetic engineering that they're very, very advanced for, and so some really different kinds of bugs. Don't mean that disrespectfully, but you know, when you're fighting them, again, not like you have every reason to fight them, but you have in the past, They can send a lot of different things after you, and I still have issues with insects and you know, there's just nothing like seeing, you know, a couple of million insects, a swarm of a couple million insects coming towards you, and they're all beetles about the size of a medium-sized dog. You know, that really turns your sense of speciesism and what it means to feel, you know, in threat and conflict and not something that's just predator-prey, but really just a completely different interspecies kind of conflict. It just changes your reality in a pretty serious way. But I will say this. They are fascinating. Plenty to be learned from them if we wanted to, you know, have better relations with them and better diplomatic contact with them. And again, they have no designs on conquest of anywhere else in the solar system or anything other than dealing with whatever their particular issues are. Now, lower life forms would include a number of, like, you know, small diggers, you know, mammalian fuzzy diggers, you call them fuzzy diggers or scaly diggers. We didn't zoologists, and we didn't get, you know, briefings from zoologists about the life of the planet, so we just come up with whatever names that we felt like it. So they're little ground birds, you know, they're about the size of a finch or something that, you know, live in the ground, and they, you know, eat bugs, they're little bugs, little insects, definitely bacteria and moldy microbial mats and things, little shrubs, little trees, little bushes. There's some places where there's even open water, where there's even open, you know, streams, tributaries, ponds. It's definitely a desert environment where it's drier, not as moist, and the air is thin, you know, kind of everywhere. And depending on where you are, it can be more or less of that. So it's not like a lush environment, but there's absolutely, you know, life there that is continuing to grow and form and develop. And as the planet continues to get back itself and reform itself and continues to balance out the gases of carbon dioxide, oxygen, and so forth, biological life, it'll come back, you know, but it may take a while.
Is there, I know some of the things that there seems like to be an incredible abundance of life there. I know when we sent up a lot of those rovers and things, you would see them in the shop, you know, when they're putting them all together, they're blue, you know, or they're white and blue. But when you see them on the Mars, they're red, you know.
Well, which, part of that is, some of that is the dust that starts to cover them, but also apparently they are filtering some of the pictures and putting sort of a red tint in them so they don't look nearly as Earth-like as some of the shots would if they didn't use this red filter.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
Some of the sand is very, very yellow. I mean, as golden yellow as any desert or beach sand that you've ever seen on planet Earth. And I've walked through valleys and across plateaus, which, you know, was not red at all, and the sky is blue, and maybe there were even clouds that day. And to be honest, if it weren't for the gravity difference, you'd really be hard pressed to be able to tell yourself definitively that you weren't walking on planet Earth and looked that much the same. Mm-hmm. So I find it very interesting, you know, what they alter and what they want people to see and how they want people to see it differently and why I always wondered, why do they want people to see it this red tint? And is it just to make it so it keeps looking foreign and hostile and it doesn't look like our world at all? Or is it just is red that color that it looks dangerous? You know, I mean, it's just because if they keep putting in it a red tint, it's always going to be ominous. I don't know. I don't completely understand.
Well, crossing, you know, let's say you're going for a walk out there. I mean, it seems like there is quite a few things that might want to take a chunk out of you.
Too many things, especially when you're wearing an environment suit that's essentially power-assisted heavy body armor. There's really not much to bite you or want to bite out of you. And if it's not one of the sentient life forms, you really don't have to worry too much. It's small. I mean, there's some... my understanding, I mean, there's definitely some poisonous, you know, spiders, bugs, insects, snakes and things, again, that if you were not protected and you didn't have gloves and boots and so forth, you'd want to be more careful. But when you're in essentially a giant plastic can, you know, which you just sort of feel like you're in a giant plastic can and you're in a big, you know, environment suit, body armor, and you feel pretty protected from stuff like bugs and snakes and lizards and stuff, it's not going to bite through that.
I used to have dreams of past lives wearing this body armor that was pretty advanced, you know. it had quite the firepower.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We pretty much had a magnetic-propelled railgun, or how you want to call it, magnetically propelled projectiles, little metal balls. When we started, we were using an 11-millimeter projectile. By the time we finished, we were using a 22-millimeter projectile. We had increased the size because of the two hearts and the double circulatory systems. They amazingly accurate because there's no kick, you know, there's no gaseous explosion. It's a quiet, still, steady magnetic propulsion, so you get a really, really steady shot. An incredible distance on Mars because of the low gravity, so you actually have the laws of physics of Newtonian mechanics change a little bit because of the, well, the equations are the same, but the numbers change because of the variable change because you're in a low gravity and so forth. So
yeah.
You can fire a projectile much, 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 much farther before it drops on Mars than you can on Earth. So you can get some crazy distance on those shots.
Yeah. I imagine you could run what? What do you think? How many times faster do you think you could run on Mars than on Earth? Or
at least twice as fast, but running is a little difficult in the suit, in the body armor.
You kind
of have to do. When I went to go see John Carter, I had to say, whoever, you know, kind of directed that first few minutes of the film when he's on Mars and he's learning how to walk gravity.
Yeah.
I was like, I swear somebody must, you know, been explaining to them how you have to do this, because you end up having to take this this sidestep where your legs don't just go in front of you. You don't do this knee up thing. You have to kind of do this side-side step in order to, because you take these bigger steps, and the only way you can sort of take these bigger steps without just falling on your face or launching yourself either forward or backward, is one of the first things you have to learn how to do in this gravity is learn how to walk again. Because when you're a toddler and you're learning how to walk, one of the first things you balance out is your upper body, lower body trajectory, so that you don't go, you're not going too top heavy or your legs don't get out in front of you, right? But by the time you've learned how to do that, you take it for granted that that's your adaptation to gravity. And as soon as you're on another planet with a different gravity, it's like being a toddler all over again, and you're either running, your upper body is either getting away with you, or your lower body is getting away with you, and you have to totally learn how to balance your upper and body, lower torso again when you're moving. So, and then that lower gravity, you get much more up, this is you more air, so you just can't take your steps right. So you have to take these kind of side steps, you take these long steps just when you're stepping, and then when you run, you also have to kind of run in slow motion. If you try to move your legs as fast as you're running, like on Earth, you would, again, you'd fall down, you couldn't do it. And because you keep taking these big, giant steps because of the low gravity, you kind of have to end up taking these slow motion steps. I'm not sure else to say that, except that you kind of take this, you know, leap right, and then leap left, and then leap right. And that's running, is these kind of big, slow steps that end up propelling you, you know, somewhere between 12 and 15 feet, you know, more at a time, and you can make some pretty amazing distance, doing that. You can go cray cray fast, really, really. And then once you jump, like if you're running at something and then you decide to jump, yeah, you get some incredible height and distance to come up and down on something. I imagine we were pretty intimidating because think about it this way, we're technically coming from a heavy gravity planet today. If someone came from a heavy gravity planet to us, we would just be amazed at how strong they would be, their ability to jump and leap and throw things. It'd be really impressive. And so I have to imagine that it would appear like that when we arrived there, that we've got these bigger, stronger muscles and we're jumping and running all over the place like giant Superman because we come from a heavier gravity planet. But it felt pretty amazing. It felt pretty amazing. And I remember the first test, you know, when we're putting on the suits and the in a test environment, which is a virtual simulator, so we're not actually outside, but it has the simulation of the gravity and the simulation of the suit. People are jumping up and getting all excited and crazy and going, woo, and jumping until the tech sergeant has to shut the suits down, the power of the suit down. Everybody comes down like lead bricks, you know, hits the ground. People just get really carried away and got really excited. Yeah, it was fun. Some aspects like that were really fun.
Sounds like a blast. Now, some of the technologies that they have, I can't mention his name, but I know somebody that worked on some of those technologies. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I know we have anti-gravity, counter-gravity, We've got some amazing healing technologies. I wonder if you could go into that. I remember that reading an article about they had a 24-hour soldier program or something where somebody would get shot or severely wounded or whatever, and they had a system that would actually repair them in 24 hours to be back out in the field, you know, from almost mortal wounds.
Sure. I can tell you what we used to have is what we used to call a holographic restructuring chamber, and essentially it's a bed or regeneration bed, which is a medical bed with like raised sides on it that they lay you down in, and no matter what state you're in, how many body parts or pieces you're missing. Now, if you are just missing a hand or a chunk of your hand or your arm or a piece of your leg, yeah, they can fix you in less than 24 hours. But at the time, we certainly, the more you had missing, the more longer it would take to put you back together. So the more pieces that were missing, you could be out, you know, for a week, week and a half if most of your body parts were blown off. Back together, but it was still incredibly fast, and being able to fix people from absolutely having arms, legs, torsos blown apart. If you have a minimal amount of electrical activity still in the brain, they can retrieve you. They can still bring you back into your body, and really, that's the difference between being dead and really dead. When you're unretrievable, then you're really dead. But until that moment, you're not dead. You're just uncertain. Even if your arms and legs are blown off and you have no blood left in your torso and you're completely unconscious and you otherwise would appear completely dead, you might not be. And it's incredible. So anyway, the computer and the system, the holographic repairing system that's attached above this bed and next to this bed, the computer system next to it, they put in a sample for a program of your original DNA from a perfect blood sample that they take before you're wounded, so that the reader can then read your perfect DNA sequence and then create a holographic projection of your perfect body down to the cell. And then it projects that through a projector right over the top of the bed. It's like this big, giant, kind of like an old school, dental x-ray machine with a big eye kind of, and a weird lens on the front of it that projects this holographic projection down onto you. It's like a 3D hologram that's kind of solid. So what happens is the parts of you that are not right, then they take all these tubes and they start sticking them into the empty spaces, and then those tubes are basic building block material, saline, aminos, and goop and things that start filling into that space. And then thanks to the amazing power of something known as dominant harmonic resonance, the materials, because they're moving over a 3D pattern of your actual perfect cellular structure, they just start to harmonize with that subatomic structure, and they become the solid cells and bones and tissue and blood vessels and organs in your body. And it can take a little while to do that, but still, that's amazing. I mean, being able to replace, those body parts that are completely gone is just an absolutely fantastic technology. I feel like what makes me, angry beyond belief is every time I see an Iraqi or an Afghanistan war veteran missing arms and legs and with a prosthetic on his arms and legs, and I'm like, that is so wrong. They have the technology to completely replace those men and women's arms and legs, and the fact that they're saying, nope, we don't have that technology, it's super top secret, and we don't have it, means that there are people who are being, soldiers who are being crippled and are not getting the best medical technology that we have and aren't getting their arms and legs back. When I did, I got all my arms and legs back every time they got blown off. And those guys don't. I think that's horribly unfair, and makes me really mad every time I do that.
Yes, I can just see you going back into the hospital missing a couple arms, going, God, I hate when this happens.
kind of.
They just put you back together.
Yeah, it's like, oh, not again,
Yeah,
it's very bizarre. It sounds surreal.
Well, it's kind of like, if you just have an open mind and you really think about this, the technologies that, back when we were playing around on the moon in the 60s, and then everything stopped, and we had this massive jump in technology, up to the 60s. And then since then, everything supposedly just kind of came to a crash other than robotics, you know, shooting them up in space and sending them up to other places. But it's amazing. But, you know, if things were to keep progressing at that rate that it was progressing, you know, the technology that we would have today would be like, you know, miraculous. It would be almost unbelievable.
Certainly. And when you factor in that we've had the assistance of ET scientists in our laboratories helping us break down and rebuild, you know, different materials and engineering devices and machines and all kinds of, you know, amazing advanced technology, we're being assisted in that process. Mm-hmm. If it was just us working it out, you're right, we'd still be way more advanced than we are. But the fact that we have some other really advanced scientists also helping us get even more advanced faster, mm-hmm. it lets you know that what's really going on at the fastest, most accelerated technological point is really, really far. Like,
yeah.
I would speculate that it's even farther than my pay grade, you know, lets me know, and that it's so far that it presents a real danger to everyone and everything, because it's so far distant from everything and everyone else on the surface of the planet.
Well, it seems like I know a lot of people, you know, within certain agencies, there's a lot of benevolent people in there that do believe, you know, in America or in the planet. You know, they want to see the planet, you know, go forward. And we have everything we need to totally restore the planet and develop the free energy technologies. And, you know, you talk to people and you go, you know, you could run that car on water, and they go, no way. And then you go, you know what, it doesn't even need tires. You know, if you employ some of this other technology, you don't even need tires. Then you go, you know, you could be, you know, having breakfast at home and lunch in Australia and dinner in China, you know, if you wanted in a blink of an eye. But they can't wrap their head around that is a potential.
Sure, yeah, because they've kept it as secret, you know, as possible, and as long as the talking head on television doesn't say so, or someone doesn't, you know, officially announce it at a White House press conference, it's not real. Mm-hmm. So for a large number of people. But I'm glad you brought that up, that there are people within the system who are trying to do good things. I would like to take just a moment to say a couple of words about United States Marine Corps Special Section. My chain of command at United States Marine Corps Special Section has been doing their job since 1953, which President Eisenhower signed into a secret executive order, the United States Marine Corps Special Section Special Code, and USMC SSSC outlines all of the articles which define the rights, behaviors, responsibilities, and duties of the United States Marine Corps Special Section, which is essentially to handle and develop methodologies and intelligence for all things exotechnological, exobiological, exodiplomatic, and assessing potential threats and or advantages, you know, towards either diplomacy or threats might be about conflict, and to assist in that process as the special study groups and the Gulf Committee in trying to come to better conclusions and better answers to things, and, you know, essentially bring as much of an orderly military intelligence process into it, while infusing in the United States Marine Corps Special Section Special Code a number of really specific wordings of laws that ensure and enable United States Marine Corps Special Section officers to not just be kind of, sort of, but actually legally bound by the special code to have a stronger moral, ethical center about their behavior, their actions, their choices, and how it affects law, constitutionality, and the three sort of branches of government. And so chain of command at USMCSS has for years, decades, been doing intelligence reports and sending those reports up the chain of command and saying, look, the way we're doing this is not going to end well. You know, we're doing projections that show this will be very bad. This will weaken us. This will weaken our economy. This will hurt us socially. This will hurt our standing globally. You know, they've really done the assessments, and they have continued to do their job and say, hey, this is not going to work out right. This is not going to be good. We should not be doing this. We should not be doing it this way. This is more harmful to the subjects that we're trying to test this sort of material and new technology on than if we did it this other way. We should really make sure that we're using ethical and moral standards as we continue to develop science and technology to advance all the different purposes of civilization. It doesn't mean just defense technology. It means defense technology and all the other technologies, including all of the other aspects of society and civilization, which are also technologies when you think about them. So our goal certainly has been to try and do a better thing with what we have and to try and use the tools and use the information that we have to suggest better things and to suggest better ideas and to suggest more ethical and moral notions, not just because we want to be goody-goody about it, but because we've done the long-term projections that show how bad things really get if you just take the shortcuts and you let corruption and you let secrecy become its own animal and its own machine in order to justify getting something done really, really fast because you think that defensively that's what you have to do, but the compromise that you're making morally and ethically and what's happening with the other compromises you're making with corruption and breaking the law and ethics, that creates an outcome down the road which may be decades projected but will be really, really, really bad, to put it very, very simply. So part of the reason why the Brigadier General, who I answer to now, Brigadier General Julian Smythe, asked me last August if I wanted to go public, which before that, I had been given permission to go ahead and write a book if I wanted to, telling my story, but not saying that it was fact, but I was going to maybe say, hey, this is fiction. But then he called me up and said, hey, I think we would like to ask if you want to go public with this. And part of their reasoning for that was, he said, look, we've done everything we can. We have written every report we can. We have complained at every meeting. We have stood up at every meeting. We have suggested everything we can suggest. And so we feel that the USMCS's special code demands that at this time we have to take action because these other conditions have been met that threaten our economic system, our social system, and our governmental system. And ultimately those threats make us weak. And by weakening us, it is our intelligence assessments that assess that those people who think that weakening us will create the society that they want do not understand that that weakening us will cause us to be attacked from outside and we will lose our sovereignty and we will lose our independence and we will lose our self-determination. Mm-hmm. So our goal by trying to be that good voice and thinking, hey, we could do some really great things with this technology, we could do some really great things with this information, at this point we have to say other people are doing such a bad thing with that if we do not, as a people and as a society and as citizens and civilians who have the right to vote and the power to, you know, demand that they're needed to do something, if we as a people do not start to act very, very, very soon, every single person on the surface of the planet who lives and breathes will die.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it does seem to be going in that direction. It's yeah. You know, I'm just blown away. I mean, we look at you know, the chemtrails, Fukushima, you know, aspartame, the fluoride. You know, you just look at, there's just a wholesale attack on the human populace right now on every level. Yeah. And you know, if we do continue, you know, in this process, it you know, especially with Fukushima, you know, that stuff just doesn't go away unless you've got some, you know, Brown's gas to neutralize it or something. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's definitely going to cause, you know, sterility rates to increase, and it's definitely going to reduce birth numbers like it was intended to. That was the purpose of having, you know, a radiation leak like that, is to sort of increase global sterility rates. That will be the goal, and that's going to happen. I would say at the moment I'm more concerned about this new Ebola breakout. I'm very, very concerned that they've brought people stateside to treat them. Not that, you know, they shouldn't be treated, but that is dangerous, bringing, you know, these really, really, really virulent, dangerous viruses into the continental United States, because if they break out here, it's going to be really bad.
Well, it seems, too, that, you know, if you add the chemtrails, which are, you know, the heavy metals are accumulative, and they're totally weakening the immune system and setting people up for something like Ebola or some other weird flu, you know.
Avian flu is the other thing I think we're going to see this year.
Yeah. And so that does seem to be a project that's definitely underway. And you know, I've always hoped that, I always felt like our only hope is the military, that there are factions within the military that are going to step up and say, you know what, enough's enough, we're not going to let this go forward. It's totally out of alignment with, you know, universal law. And you know, that's been one of my hopes.
Well, I'm glad that you've had that hope. And I am here to tell you, as the Brigadier General told me to say, you know, when I was having, I get weekly briefings with him now. And I was talking to him earlier this week. feeling a little confused, or maybe just like, you know, come on, what am I supposed to be doing here? I understand I'm telling people this and talking about this and that, but, you know, what am I really supposed to be doing here? And he said, "You're a beacon of light and hope." And I'm like, mm-hmm. "Yeah, you're a beacon of light and hope right now." He says, "Right now, I want you to be telling people the message of what's going on, and not, you know, yeah, it's bad, but, you know, there's the beacon of light and hope. If people start to act and get together and know that there's things going on behind the scenes, there's hope here." And I will say this about our military. We have some of the most wonderful men and women whose families have made up the warrior caste of the United States of America since before the Civil War. And we have some fabulous officers who, believe me, as this whole thing has started to go down, they have not been happy about that, and they have not been okay with it. Mm-hmm. But knowing that in some ways they're not in the majority of power, and that those who have openly, you know, opposed that sort of power have gotten steamrolled, you know, railroaded, driven out of their own office into other offices, and, you know, made to sort of hang out to dry and then kicked out. Shinseki is a perfect example of that. I mean, he was driven from a very, very high level, you know, Army chief of staff position down to a job at the Veterans Administration that they knew he would fail at. I mean, he was sent to that job to fail. They made sure he was mm-hmm. surrounded by people that he couldn't work with and that wouldn't implement the things that he wanted to implement, would create this disaster for him, and then they could railroad him right out of town, which, guess what, they did. So that definitely happens to people. But I will say this, there's absolutely a very strong moral, ethical officer corps who has, you know, will be damned to let, you know, their fathers and their grandfathers and their great-grandfathers and their great-great-grandfathers, you know, be disremembered by, you know, us turning into some kind of pro-fascist, completely unconstitutional, anti-American way of life. So I will assure you, and that is one of the things I'm here for, that irregardless of what you see on the public sphere and in the open, and irregardless of what you see in the media, know that there are men and women who take their oaths very seriously, take the adherence to constitutional law and the bending and breaking of that constitutional law very seriously, and that when you're talking about something that is so complex, so entrenched, and so many parties are at play, and so many different extraterrestrial alliances have come in to mm-hmm. mess with that over the last 70 years, this is one of the most complicated chessboards, most complicated chess games that have ever been played. So try and understand that the good men and women who are trying to sort that out can't just play this like a football game and run down the field. That's not how this is. It's a chess game, and they have to play it much smarter and much more carefully. Mm-hmm. And I will say that, as the Brigadier tells me from time to time, he says, "Look, just know this. We're better chess players than they are. So it may take a little longer. It may look like we're not getting it done as fast as it should be done." He says, "But we're better chess players than they are, and eventually we will win because we've thought this out more moves than they mm-hmm. have." So that's your beacon of light and hope right there, is that there are good men and women in the officer corps and mm-hmm. the enlisted corps of the military who have taken this very seriously, and they are doing things. Yeah, they can't just come out and say it. And that's one of the reasons why I'm here talking about it, because they can't. So they're doing what they're doing.
Great. That's awesome to hear. You know, speaking of these other beings, I don't know if you have a program or a roster on who's who in the galaxy, but I'd love to hear, you know, some of your take on, I know they have different beings, you know, they have like an Orion Council of Light, and they've got Pleiadians, and they've got Andromedans, and Arcturians, and a lot of beings that are humanoid, you know, that have that love frequency, and that are part of our ancestry, you know, that are here to help us. And then there's, you know, there's other factions out there that are pretty diabolical, you know, some of these serpent beings and reptilian beings and some regenerate grays and things of that nature. I'd love to get your take on that, on kind of like who's who in the galaxy.
Wow, that is so complicated. I mean, I'm happy to talk about that, but really it's so, so complicated. In fact, when we get talking about that, we sort of have to start talking about what I call my grand cluster fudge theory.
Uh-huh.
Because at some point, when you start to realize how many different groups and how many different agendas and how many different alliances have changed and continue to change and agreements change and aggression changes, that trying to follow along and keep up with it is really like just trying to keep up with a grand cluster of fudge, except it's not fudge, right? It's just, it's horribly complicated and gets horribly confusing. And it changes. This is the other thing. I was being told one thing was happening up until last August, and then I was informed, no, things have changed. And then I was sort of thinking we were doing one thing, and then when this whole Gaza thing started, my briefing with the Brigadier was, whatever you thought we were going to talk about, we need to talk about the Middle East right now. And then the Ukraine thing happened. It's like, okay, whatever you thought we were going to talk about, we need to talk about that now. And so as things start happening, I'm being told there's a real attempt to accelerate timelines here. So there may have been, 6 months ago, 12 months ago, people saying, yeah, we need to do this over the next 3 to 5 years. And this week they're saying we need to do that now. Yeah. So I have had to rephrase myself to several people and say, whatever I said before, I was wrong as far as like how long this may take or what's happening. I was wrong. And what appears to be the case at the moment is it all looks very, very, very bad. And it looks like that there are people who are really trying to ramp up some serious World War III style aggression and really get the grandest distraction that they can go in and put all these other things into motion, which may involve a number of, viruses and diseases being released worldwide, may involve a number of types of disasters, both environmental and natural, unnatural and man-made, and, gas line explosions like that in Taiwan, as well as what, may start to become either a hoax invasion or another kind of invasion. I mean, it's all going to just be very confused very soon, and it's going to get really insane. What I'm hearing in my briefings is where we thought this may have been, it's going to get dragged out a little bit longer. We've kind of seen this month that maybe everyone looks like what they're doing is starting to accelerate their timeline. So for some reason, and I don't have the right information to answer why this is, but for some reason, everybody at these higher levels has been given some information or some intelligence that's causing them to accelerate and act faster in whatever it is that they were doing or whatever was going on.
Yeah.
So I don't know why, but everyone's stepping it up, everyone's ramping it up, and Netanyahu is certainly pushing for the biggest, fight that he can with everybody by trying to incite the entire rest of the region by just massacring Gazans and hoping that that would get everybody mad and riled up and attacking Israel. He's hoping to drag Iran into it, drag the UK and the US into it, drag nuclear arms into it. He's under the impression that by doing this, that whichever ETs that he's kissing butt to right now will then, sort of come down and present this sort of, grand holy war, God-type invasion, which I don't think is true. I think they're lying to him. I think they just want him to start a war and then watch everybody die, and then they're going to stand back and go, you're stupid. You trusted us.
Yeah.
But tell him that. He doesn't believe that for a second. He thinks he's assuring his place in history as, the grand savior of Israel, but it's just not going to be true. So he's completely delusional about it, completely mad with power, and has intentions to try and blow up the whole world right now. So, let me specify, this is not a fight between Jews and Muslims. It's never been a fight between Jews and Muslims. This is about a defense contracting industry who wishes to make a lot of money pitching two sides against one another and benefiting from that conflict. So I just want to make that perfectly clear, that this has never been or never has or never will be a conflict that is really about religious differences. People on the ground may think of it that way, but it really isn't and never has been or never will be.
Yeah, it's always been, I wrote about that back in the 80s, early 80s. I was talking about there's never been a holy war. There's always been one king or leader wanting what another one has, now it's one industry wanting to keep itself going, creating a villain or whatever. And I know Wernher von Braun warned us about that, They even laid it out. They said, here's the different wars you're going to have. This is where it's going to go. Here, and then it's going to go to a false ET invasion, which is the next card. But I don't know. Hopefully, enough people have spilled the beans on that one. They won't pull that. So who knows?
I've thought about that, and what I think is, it's not going to matter. It's not going to matter that enough people have talked about it. It's not going to matter whether some people think that it's a hoax or some people think that it's real. The point is that when they do it, it will have an impact on the social, economic, environmental factors that will simply force everyone to deal with it as if it were real.
Yeah.
And so it won't matter whether we've all talked about it or not. It's still going to kind of happen anyway. What I'm more curious to sort of understand is more of the nuts and bolts of how, you know, it's supposed to work itself out. Which, you know, what poser species are they going to use or make up to try and be the invaders? And, you know, how are they going to sort of try and, you know, present that story? And it's either, my understanding of the story will either get presented as, oh, look, here comes, you know, this bad invading ET. Oh, no. And then, oh, look, here comes our friend, good ET, to save us. And then in that drama, you know, this other ET will chase away the bad ET, and then you will say, I'm your friend. And then we'll have this whole conversation control about exopolitics. Because if you have one species who's the good guy who comes down and then gives you all the information through your media sources on what to believe, then you have one controlling dialogue about who the intergalactic brothers and sisters are and who they are. Because what they fear the most is that if the people really got just open access to the EVE manual, which would just tell us that we don't have just one good guy or bad guy out there. We have dozens of other choices as far as how we can think or be or behave, or, you know, do we, for instance, if we started looking at all these other advanced species and we started looking at their cultures in detail, one of the first things that we would realize is that an incredibly tiny, 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 tiny number of them have capitalistic market-based systems. And yeah. So the first thing that we have to realize is that, hey, why are we using this antiquated 15th century economic system when it's the 21st century and we should be using a completely new, you know, 21st century economic model? And realizing that there are ET species and civilizations who've been doing that for a very long time, and they can explain to us the, you know, the very real legal, you know, structures and bureaucratic structures and social structures and, you know, in engineering and manufacturing structures mm-hmm. that had to be created and balanced out to make that happen. And so once we got a look at that, we would go, hey, we don't like the way you're doing it here. So one of the reasons why they absolutely don't want us to know that is because they want to keep controlling the information on mm-hmm. what we think exists out there. So as long as they can control that dialogue, you know, they can keep doing this for a certain number of years, whether it's 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. You know, they're just trying to play out this clock and drag it out and make as much money and keep as much power for as long as possible, hoping that they'll be waiting out this sort of clock of change, the sort of temporal nexus of high probability that we're in that has this potential for huge change and huge shift in everything that they're doing. And they're hoping that if they can wait that out, then they'll be able to sort of solidify that, you know, capitalistic market-based system again after we're out of that. So mm-hmm. there's definitely going to be some changes. There needs to be some changes. The questions are really going to be who's dictating and turning those changes. And is it going to be controlled by their conversation, or is it going to be controlled by a more natural conversation, or by a conversation that more positive ETs want to sort of, you know, be able to sort of not as much dictate as make sure that we have the option of having that dialogue instead of just having one conversation mm-hmm. coming from, you know, supposedly good ET, air quotes.
Yeah. There does seem to be, you know, from my understanding, you know, we are in moving through a new place, a highly energized place in space that we haven't really been before, you know, in recorded history that we know about. And, you know, moving into alignment with galactic plane, and it's creating atmospheric changes on all the planets. And we've been, you know, they've been talking to us about these huge shifts of energy coming in that, and every time they give us a date and say, hey, this is going to go on for 2 weeks, or this is going to go on for a month, this major shift is going to be coming through of energy, and the energy is not, you know, it's neither good nor bad. It just amplifies everything, and then right. And then we get to watch the outcome of that one. But they've been right on this, and it just seems like that is increasing exponentially. And
oh, yeah.
And the people that are focused on tyranny and control and domination, they're not frequency specific to where the Earth is going and where where we're evolving to, so that they aren't going to be doing too well in the days to come with these new shifts happening.
I would strongly suspect that the very, very, very rigid framework and the very, very rigid scaffolding that they have created, in which they are standing upon and lofting themselves above the rest of us with, will start to become very fragile and will start to shake apart and will start to become very weak and very vulnerable because of, yeah, again, really just making very, very poor decisions when it comes to the stability of their structure and their marketplace. And I think it's essentially going to come back to bite them in the butt pretty soon.
Yeah, it does seem to be going in that direction. You know, I always say when you really look at these forces that are coming in and the extremely advanced, you know, off-world beings that have, you know, they have creational energies, you know, they have abilities to do things that will be total miracles for us. You know, when I look at that and I look at the Earth spirit, her spirit alone as well, you know, and her choice and where she's going, it does definitely... I just don't see there's any way out for them other to either evolve and move towards the awakening healing process, or they're going to basically devolve and implode.
Well, this has a lot to do with the decision-making process to change Alternative 3, because as it became, Alternative 3 started out as this, ooh, what are we going to do if we get to this point where the planet's, you know, too polluted and too overpopulated, and, you know, as we're trying to develop all this technology, we need to preserve ourselves with underground bases or with a moon base or with a colony on Mars. And that early discussion started to change as the notion of, you know, sort of dimensional shift or ascension and all these other notions of real, not just sort of material shifting, but real fabric of time-space shifting. That is, these theories started to become, you know, more talked about. People started to get really concerned and think, oh, wow, we don't necessarily want to be here for that. So part of their strategy has been to, A, do anything and everything they can to get away from it. So part of the reason they wanted to get to the moon and get to Mars is in case there is some kind of, you know, dimensional or something, that they're not going to be physically present for it, so they don't have to get dragged into it, because they don't want to get dragged into that. They think it would be a terrible thing to them. So everything that they've done is either try to get away from that physically, or then to try and enact damage onto the planet and its own energy field in order to try and stop it from happening. So they've absolutely been concerned about that, and have absolutely made serious attempts to try and insulate themselves, protect themselves from it, and or change the planet in a way that they think, you know, they can stop it. And I'll give them this. They've done a lot of damage and have gotten very far away. I do not think, though, that it's sufficient for their purposes. I think that the planet's ability to essentially shift itself is much larger than their ability to affect it. I seriously don't think that just because they get a certain number of even millions of miles away, that the consciousness of the collective unconsciousness of human beings that would be shifted on planet Earth would not affect them. They would still, they're still attached to the collective unconscious, and they would still be affected by it no matter where they are. So right. I think they're trying to run away from it, but I don't think they can.
You know, we're hitting up the end of the hour, unfortunately. I got to bring you back on again because we've got so many unfinished questions I've got to cover. Is there a way people can contact you, or do you want people to contact you? And
certainly people can contact me through my website, which is earthcitizenconsulting.org. I have contact information there, and people can certainly, you know, get a little idea of where I'm coming from and what we're trying to accomplish by looking at the site. But absolutely, people who at this point, my job is to consult. So people who are trying to transition socially, personally, psychically, spiritually, technologically, that's what I do, help people transition both personal, business, social, civic organizations, military, and government organizations. We're all about here to talk about moving and shifting whatever they're doing to something better. So, yeah, anybody who wants to talk about it can contact me through my website, and I will be happy to discuss whatever people wanted to talk about that's useful towards shifting what we're doing to a better place, or helping them with their own personal process and that of the process of their business company, civic organization, military, governmental organization and or city state.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, hey, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. We get you back on, we'll talk about some of the inner earth stuff going on and some of the higher dimensional stuff that's popping in here over the ranch, and we can go more into depth into that. But unfortunately, we're out of time.
Oh, well, you're going to have to start doing a longer show.
Yeah, definitely. Hey, well, keep up the great work, and tell your higher-ups thank you so much for their efforts, and we're all behind them.
Thank you, James. Semper Fi.
All right, take care.
Too,
thanks for coming on the show. All right, got to sign off. This is James Gunn with As You Wish Talk Radio. Signing off. Have a great evening and get ready for part 2.